made me angry. He replied flatly, "Whatever gave you the idea folk in authority operate according to reason? Your trouble is you're being irrational." And so his story was supposed to go the same way as Henry Smith Williams. It was supposed to be forgotten. But this time, something was different. I got on a plane to Geneva, the Swiss city where Harry Anslinger first went to the United Nations to force his vision on the world. It was there, in a sweet twist of history, that his grip was finally being broken. I sat with the woman who, along with others, pioneered this change, and she began to tell me her story. It had been inspired, without him knowing it, by John Marx. The police officer who accompanied Ruth Dreyfus had tears in his eyes. He was taking the future president of Switzerland through an abandoned railway station in Zurich, down by the river. All the local drug addicts had been herded there, like infected cattle. Ruth had been looking out over scenes like this for years now. A few years before, she had been to the park in Bern that played the same role there. There were girls being openly prostituted out, and there were addicts staggering around, out of control, incoherent. There were people injecting themselves in places you couldn't imagine, she says, because every other vein couldn't be traced, as if it was trying to escape. Above the bustle, dealers were yelling their prices at the top of their voices. As she heard them, Ruth thought of Wall Street brokers barking on the trading floor. The threat of violence hung over everything as dealers fought for customers. Most Swiss people had never seen anything like this. The police were not just crying, they were afraid. This was Switzerland in the 1980s and 1990s, but it was an affront to everything the Swiss thought about themselves. Switzerland has always been the place on earth where it is easiest to pretend nothing ever changes and everything makes sense. My father is a mountain boy from the Swiss Alps, and in his village you were raised to believe that the country's last major upset was when Hannibal invaded the mountains with his elephants in 221 BC. All the country's symbols are about order and cleanliness and permanence. Swiss watches will tick-tock with scientific precision even after a nuclear holocaust. The postcards show the 30-foot-high cleansing jet-blue water waving out from Lake Geneva into the sky, with the Alps motionless and unchanging in the distance. It is, the Swiss will tell you gravely, a criminal offence to flush your toilet after 10 o'clock at night because it might disturb your neighbours. But now, Switzerland was watching as drug prohibition created tornadoes in the middle of its pristine clockwork cities. Ruth Dreyfus didn't know it yet as she walked through this scene, but soon she was going to become the first female president of Switzerland and the first Jewish president of Switzerland. Even more significant, she would become the first president in the world since the 1930s who decided to run not away from drug reform, but toward it. She dedicated her presidency to sitting with addicts, listening to addicts, defending addicts, and getting them a legal supply of their drugs. I first learned about her when drug policy experts began to say that there was one political leader in the world who really understood what was wrong with the drug war better than anyone else. I wrote to her at once. That's how I found myself in early 2013 in her apartment, as she chain-smoked and flicked her ash into a big yellow ashtray. She apologized for the smoke. "I'm an addict," she said, and laughed. When Billie Holiday was in prison for heroin possession in the United States, the only people who tried to help her were Swiss. "A wonderful couple in Zurich, Switzerland, sent me $1,000, she wrote, and a telegram telling me that America would never accept me when I got out, so I should come to them in Europe. Switzerland is, like all countries, in a constant tussle between its compassion and its cruelty. As that letter was being written, Ruth was at a Swiss school, where the other kids would sometimes taunt her, saying that the Jews had assassinated Jesus and would have to be punished forever. Later, Ruth was told that, as a woman, she was hysterical and emotional and couldn't be trusted with the vote. If they ever let her cast a ballot, the country's politicians warned, Switzerland's families would fall apart and the nation would descend into chaos. It was only after she and thousands of others marched and demanded for years that Swiss women were finally enfranchised in 1971. So Ruth Dreyfus had seen how even the most concrete of certainties can fall apart and seem crazy to the next generation. When Ruth was put in charge of Switzerland's health policy in 1993, there was a corpse waiting in her in-tray. Switzerland had the worst HIV epidemic in Europe, and nobody could see an end to it. This country has no ghettos where addiction could be hidden away. There are no us and them in Swiss chalets. If chaotic drug use is happening, it happens where everyone can see. So she gathered into her office representatives of the country's most despised minorities, gays, prostitutes, and junkies, because she suspected that they held not only the problem, but also the solution to the AIDS crisis. She found that sex workers, if you arm them with condoms and information, are actually very good public health agents, but you have to trust them. You have to accept their job. So prevention begins with respect. As a socialist, she had always believed that everyone, no matter how seemingly lost, can be empowered if you do it right. But she looked at the drug addicts and asked herself, how? In the fight against AIDS, Switzerland had already built good needle exchanges, provided safe consumption rooms where addicts could go to take their drugs, and prescribed methadone. Still, the disease raged. It turned out that many addicts loathe methadone. They compare it to a flavorless lump of dough when you have a ravenous craving for steak. One day, some of the street doctors Ruth talked to all the time told her that they had been to visit an experiment in Liverpool, England, a program with startling results, even though the ideologues were shutting its doors. It had been discovered a few years before in Switzerland that there was a clause in Swiss law that allowed heroin to be given to citizens provided it was part of a scientific experiment. So far, that had been done with only a tiny handful of people. So Ruth said, "Okay, we are going to have a really large experiment. We are going to make it much easier for any addict who wants it to get methadone, and for the people who can't cope with that, we will prescribe them heroin." Switzerland has a political system built on consensus. No one official can drive a policy on her own. She needed to persuade her colleagues and the cantons. So Ruth fought for it. "This is an emergency," she explained. "And in emergencies, you take dramatic steps." 20 years later, Ruth Dreyfus lives across the street from one of the heroin-prescribing clinics in Geneva that were made possible by her political battle. At 7 in the morning, I hurry past the seagulls squawking on Lake Geneva. It is as dark as midnight, and in the neat little Swiss cafes, men and women in suits are reading newspapers and drinking coffee. Nobody seems bleary-eyed. The Swiss go to bed early, and they wake in the darkness without complaining. In the white corridor of the heroin clinic, I find a young man with big headphones and an old man in a tweed suit with leather elbow patches sitting in chairs next to each other. They are waiting patiently to shoot up. The older man follows a nurse into the injecting room, and he emerges a little while later to sit for 20 minutes alone, and then he agrees to talk to me in a room to one side. He looks like the Secretary of State for a minor Central European nation, with his carefully polished shoes and lined, distinguished face. After we are introduced by the doctors, he says he will tell me his story, provided I do not use his real name, because he was admitting to criminal offences he had carried out before the drug laws were changed. I will call him Jean. I was sick. I was dirty. When he first came here, he says, I was really quite a typical addict. He couldn't concentrate to watch a film for more than a few minutes. He couldn't eat fruit or anything even vaguely greasy because his digestive system was so curdled by the street contaminants. He had been shooting up for 35 years. When you are using on the street, you feel death already hiding inside you. You can feel it, and you can see it, he says. You have death inside yourself, and death is progressing. He tried methadone, but it did nothing for him. He still craved heroin all the time. He would wake each morning in a flop sweat of panic, asking himself, how am I going to get the money I need to buy my smack today? He was trapped in the constant misery-go-round of get money, buy heroin, inject, get money, buy heroin, inject, all day, every day. It's not just an addiction. It's a job, he says. He survived only by being involved in drug trafficking. He doesn't want to give the details, except to say that he was a middleman. Until one day, he heard about the prescription program established by Ruth Dreyfus. This is the last option in the system for people who cannot be helped any other way. To be eligible, you need to meet three conditions. You have to be over 18, you have to have gone through at least two other treatment programs without success, and you have to hand in your driver's license. It wasn't easy to accept and see at first, he says. All addicts are in a total confusion. Suddenly, his constant scrambling for his drugs was taken away, and he had a day ahead of him he had to fill. He tells me patients here have to reinvent our lives. We have to reinvent the imagination. The heroin program is built around helping the patients to slowly rebuild, to get therapy, to get a home, and to get a job. One of Jean's fellow patients, for example, owns a gas station, while another works in a bank. He discovered that once you have stability, the speed of events decreases, and you come back into a normal life, and you say, okay, what am I going to do now? It's hard to do this after being addicted for so long, but Jean says, the pain I have now isn't the pain of a sickness. It's the pain of being reborn. For the first time in decades, I feel well and happy to have recovered things I had completely forgotten. He has started to eat fruit and watch films and listen to music again. You can come back, he says, to reality. Harry Anslinger believed he had spotted the crucial flaw in heroin prescription programs like this. Addicts' bodies gradually develop a tolerance for their drug, so he said they would need higher and higher doses over time to achieve the same effect. The addict is never satisfied with his dose. He always tries to get more, he explained. He praised two of his officers who laid out what they called the first law of addiction. A person in the condition of opiate addiction, with free access to opiates, will continue in that condition at an accelerated rate of consumption unless the course of addiction is deterred by some extraneous force. That observation seems to make sense. Yet at this clinic, they tell me, they have discovered something that contradicts it. If you are an addict here, and you want a higher dose of heroin, you can ask for it, and they'll give it to you. So at first, most addicts demand more and more, just as Anslinger and his agents predicted. But within a few months, most addicts stop asking for more and choose, of their own free will, to stabilize their doses. After that, most of them want to go always down, explains the psychiatrist here, Dr. Rita Mangi. Jean, for example, started at the clinic taking heroin 3 times a day. 80 milligrams in the morning, 60 milligrams in the afternoon, and 80 milligrams in the evening. Now he takes only 30 milligrams in the morning and 40 milligrams in the evening. And he says, I'm on the brink of saying to my doctor, I don't want any more. He is a typical user here. Suddenly, the slightly depressing debate at the start of the drug war between Harry Anslinger and Henry Smith Williams, prohibition forever versus prescription forever, seems bogus. But in this clinic, they have discovered that that isn't the real choice. If you give hardcore addicts the option of a safe, legal prescription and allow them to control the dose, the vast majority will stabilize and then slowly reduce their drug consumption over time. Prescription isn't an alternative to stopping your drug use. It is, for many people, a path to it. This program, Jean says, gives you the chance to recover the control you have lost, step by step, day by day. A Portuguese psychiatrist who treats people here, Dr. Daniel Martin, tries to explain it to me by giving me a visual image. Most addicts here, he says, come with an empty glass inside them. When they take heroin, the glass becomes full, but only for a few hours, and then it drains down to nothing again. The purpose of this program is to gradually build a life for the addict so they can put something else into the empty glass, a social network, a job, some daily pleasures. If you can do that, it will mean that even as the heroin drains, you are not left totally empty. Over time, as your life has more in it, the glass will contain more and more, so it will take less and less heroin to fill it up. And in the end, there may be enough within you that you feel full without any heroin at all. Users can stay on this program for as long as they want, but the average patient will come here for 3 years, and at the end of that time, only 15% are still using every day. Before, being a heroin addict was violent and thrilling. You were chasing and charging around. In Switzerland today, it is rather dull. It involves sitting in clinics and being offered cups of tea. The subculture is gone. After the clinics opened, the people of Switzerland started to notice something. The parks and railway stations that were filled with addicts emptied. Today, children play there once again. The streets became safer. The people on heroin prescriptions carry out 55% fewer vehicle thefts and 80% fewer muggings and burglaries. This fall in crime was almost immediate, the most detailed academic study found. The HIV epidemic among drug users stopped. In 1995, some 68% of new HIV infections in Switzerland were caused by injection drug use. But by 2009, it was down to approximately 5%. The number of addicts dying every year fell dramatically. The proportion with permanent jobs tripled, and every single one had a home. A third of all addicts who had been on welfare came off it altogether, and just as in Liverpool, the pyramid selling by addicts crumbled to sand. People on the heroin prescription program for a sustained period were 94.7% less likely to sell drugs than before their treatment. Jean tells me the drug dealers he used to work for are completely against this program. They can control people in weak states and make money from them. If I was still in the criminal milieu, they would make me a killer. I would do anything. As he said this, I thought of Chino and Rosalio. But now, no, I am lost for them. The program costs 35 Swiss francs per patient per day, but it spares the taxpayer from having to spend 44 francs a day arresting, trying, and convicting the drug user. So when people ask, "Why should I pay for this?" the pragmatic Swiss answer is, "This doesn't cost you money. It saves you money." But I was still wondering all the time, how did Ruth manage to sell these policies in such a conservative country? My Swiss relatives are often way to the right of the Tea Party, and they are regarded as moderates. This isn't like people opting for drug reform in San Francisco. It's like people opting for drug reform in Lubbock, Texas. I knew she couldn't have gone over the people's heads, because Switzerland has a system of deep democracy. If you are a Swiss citizen and you don't like a law passed by the parliament, all you have to do is gather 50,000 signatures and you will trigger a national referendum on whether it should be struck down entirely. In the late 1990s, a conservative group triggered a national referendum on heroin prescription, and there was a rowdy national debate. Or as rowdy as Switzerland ever gets. Ruth and many people who agreed with her introduced something to the drug debate that nobody had ever tried anywhere else in the world. Ever since Anslinger, the drug warriors had presented themselves as the forces of order ranged against the chaos that would inevitably be brought by any relaxation of the drug laws. But, in a political jiu-jitsu move, Ruth reversed that argument. Swiss citizens could see now that US-style drug crackdowns had brought chaos to their streets, and after the government provided a legal route to heroin, the chaos vanished. So they argued that the drug war means disorder, while ending the drug war means slowly restoring order. This argument won. In 1997, some 70% of Swiss electors voted to keep the reforms. In 2008, the conservative forces regrouped and called another referendum. The campaign supported by Ruth ran posters of a young mother with her baby saying, "I want to keep our public parks free of syringes." Another poster showed a couple in their 50s saying, "Thanks to treatment, our son could quit drugs." This time, 68% backed the policy. These campaigns showed, in embryo, the case that, I believe, could end prohibition around the world. They did it to protect and defend not the addicts, but themselves. This is, it occurs to me, a crucial lesson for drug reformers. Those of us who believe in ending the drug war already pretty much have the liberals and leftists on our side. It's the moderates and the conservatives we need to win over. And the way to do it may be heard in a distant yodel from the mountaintops of Switzerland. One day, Ruth went as president to a heroin clinic in Bern to talk to the addicts there. And among them was one young man, well-dressed and handsome, whom she tried to strike up a conversation with. But he seemed shy and would barely say a word to her. To her surprise, as she was leaving, he handed her a note and said she should wait until she was back in her office before reading it. 6 months ago, I was in the streets, he said. I hated myself. I had lost all respect for myself. I was dirty. I slept outside in the streets and the parks. And then I was accepted in the clinic. And now I am coming 3 times a day to receive my heroin. I regained respect. And then he explained that he had been reluctant to talk to her because now he worked for her, in the department she runs. "When you read such a letter," she says, "you can continue for many years on that." It's hard, I say to Ruth in her apartment in Geneva one afternoon, to imagine an American president or British prime minister doing what she has done, sitting with addicts, learning their stories, and urging people to help them. "They should," she says. "You have to learn and to see with their own eyes." If she was stuck in an elevator with Barack Obama and David Cameron, she would tell them, "You are responsible for all of your citizens, and being responsible means protecting them and giving them the means to protect themselves. There is no group that you can abandon." Yet the same forces that had pressured Britain into locking down John Marks tried to intimidate the Swiss. The International Narcotics Control Board declared, "Anyone who plays with fire loses control over it," and said Switzerland was sending a disastrous signal to countries in which the drugs were produced. But Ruth Dreyfus was not going to be intimidated by anyone. When the U.S. drug czar, General Barry McCaffrey, visited Europe, he went to the Netherlands and held a press conference at which, like a colonial governor addressing the natives, he berated the Dutch government for their wickedness. He was scheduled to come to Switzerland shortly after. "It was terrible what he said in the Netherlands about the cannabis shops," Ruth says. So she called him and explained, "There will be no press conference in Switzerland. We do not accept for you to interfere in our political debate." Once she left office, Ruth came together with other former heads of state, including President Fernando Henrique Cardoso of Brazil, to set up an organization called the Global Commission on Drug Policy, demanding an end to the global drug war. When I spoke to her, she had recently been to Mexico, Ghana, Budapest, Vilnius, and Italy. Everywhere she goes, she says, she can see that doubts are rising, and people are eager to hear about the rational alternatives. "It's even harder to imagine," I tell her, "a former U.S. president or British prime minister living a minute's walk from a heroin clinic." "As far as possible, we always wanted to have these places in the center of the city," she says, smoking a cigarette and flicking the ash. "For many reasons. I mean, these people have to come regularly. We can't send them I don't know where. When they have a job, it's important they can come during the lunch break or so. It's practical." And she looks out the window, in the direction of the heroin clinic. After I returned from Switzerland, I enthusiastically jabbered to several Americans about these results and said they should be tried back in the land of the free, and they often came back with a response that threw me. "But we already prescribe powerful opiates," they said. "We prescribe OxyContin and Vicodin and other painkillers, and, far from having the effect you are describing, it has caused a disaster. Look," they said, "at the headlines any day of the week. More people are becoming addicted every year to prescription drugs that they were given at first for pain relief. More people are overdosing. More people are becoming criminals. More people are transferring to even harder drugs, like heroin. You want more of that?" The narrative was everywhere, including in liberal outlets normally receptive to drug policy reform, like Rolling Stone. The conclusion seemed obvious. For some reason, in this country, prescription doesn't reduce problems, it metastasizes them. This seemed to blast a hole in the case for providing legal access to the most potent drugs in the United States, and I was sent into a spiral of confusion. I looked over the evidence, and these critics seemed to be right. OxyContin and Vicodin addictions are indeed spreading in the United States, and they are causing more criminality and overdose. The cause, everyone seems to agree, is that doctors have prescribed the drugs too freely. How could it be, I asked myself, that opiate prescription worked so well in Switzerland, but was proving to be a disaster in the United States? Is this just a deep cultural difference, or is there a flaw in the Swiss model that I'm not seeing? It was only when I discussed this with Megan Ralston, an expert on prescription drugs with the Drug Policy Alliance, with Professor Bruce Alexander back in Vancouver, and with Dr. Hal Voors, a medical doctor who treats prescription drug addicts in Oklahoma City, that I began to understand what was really happening. Between them, these three experts raised three different questions that forced me to see the prescription drug crisis in a radically different light. The first question that made me think again is, when do the worst problems associated with OxyContin and Vicodin, the ones you see on the news, start? When do addicts start to hold up pharmacies to get their next batch, or prostitute themselves, or start overdosing on a massive scale? Megan Ralston, one of the leading experts on this crisis, explained to me, "They don't begin when the drugs are prescribed. They begin when the prescriptions are cut off." The United States, she explained, doesn't have a Swiss-style policy of prescribing OxyContin or Vicodin or other opiates to addicts. In fact, it has precisely opposite policy. If I am an American who has developed an OxyContin addiction, as soon as my doctor realizes I'm an addict, she has to cut me off. She is allowed to prescribe to treat only my physical pain, not my addiction. Indeed, if she prescribes just to meet my addiction, she will face being stripped of her license and up to 25 years in jail as a common drug dealer, just like Henry Smith Williams' brother at the birth of the drug war. That's when, in desperation, I might hold up a pharmacy with a gun, or go and buy unlabeled pills from street dealers. Most of the problems attributed to prescription drugs in the United States, Megan Ralston says, begin here, when the legal, regulated route to the drug is terminated. Nobody, she explained to me, swallows 80 milligrams of OxyContin prescribed by their doctor and goes out to commit a crime, or dies of an overdose. No, it's when the doctor realizes the patient is an addict and cuts them off that all the trouble begins. This is so different from how the prescription drug crisis has been almost universally reported that it took some time for me to absorb it. It was only when I began to think about it in relation to the last time drugs were sold freely in the United States, before 1914, that I started to understand. Remember the transformation Henry Smith Williams lived through? Before the ban, almost all opiate users would buy a mild form of the drug at their corner store for a small price. A few did become addicts, and that meant their lives were depleted, in the same way that an alcoholic's life is depleted today. Nobody should dismiss this effect. It is real human suffering. But virtually none of them committed crimes to get their drug, or became wildly out of control, or lost their jobs. Then the legal routes to the drug were cut off, and all the problems we associate with drug addiction began. Criminality, prostitution, violence. The same pattern is playing out today with prescription drugs. If I am a young man with a legal OxyContin prescription that I am using compulsively to deal with my psychological pain, my life will be depleted and sluggish and incomplete. If I am cut off from that prescription, if my own personal 1914 hits me, my life will become disastrous, and I will start acting in all the chaotic ways associated with the prescription drug crisis today. It is when the legal routes are cut off that the worst begins. So, Megan says, the prescription drug crisis doesn't discredit legalization. It shows the need for it. But what does legalization mean when it comes to prescription drugs? Some people would argue that they should be openly sold, like alcohol. But I think Switzerland's heroin experiment shows a better path forward. You could expand the criteria for prescription. If you can prescribe opiates for back pain, why can't you prescribe them for psychological pain? Imagine if a woman addicted to Oxy in Oklahoma City wasn't abruptly told to stop using, with directions to the nearest Narcotics Anonymous group and a brisk good luck. Imagine if, instead, she was told exactly what the patients in Geneva are told. You will be given a safe, legal dose for as long as you need it, and while you receive it, we will give you support and care to help you rebuild your life, get secure housing, and keep your job. It seems reasonable to expect that the results would be the same in Vermont or Alabama as they were in Switzerland, that most people would, over time, choose to reduce their dose and eventually give up their drugs as their pain abated. But that's only the first step. It's the bandage that stops the hemorrhaging. Then you need to have a deeper strategy, one that stops these wounds from forming in the first place. To do that, you need to change the culture so people find life less unbearable. We have to build a society that looks more like Rat Park and less like a rat race. If that sounds like pie in the sky, remember the alternative. Addiction outbreaks that only swell, like an oxy slick forming across the sky. This leads to the second question. Why did the prescription drug crisis radically accelerate in the past decade? There are two possible explanations. The first is the only one any of us have ever heard. It says that doctors, urged on by the greed of Big Pharma, have been handing out these legal opiates for conditions such as back pain, without properly warning their patients about the risk of addiction. And as a result, lots of people are becoming accidentally addicted. You go to the doctor, you take a painkiller believing it'll only deal with your slipped disc. After a few months of taking it, you find that your body needs these chemicals in a very real physical sense. And you can't give them up without going into terrible withdrawal and panic. This is what most people believe has driven this crisis, and it seems like common sense. But there's a crucial piece of evidence that has been omitted from this picture. As we saw earlier, in hospitals across the West, people are given much more powerful opiates than OxyContin and Vicodin, day in, day out. For example, the diamorphine, heroin, you will be given if you have a knee replacement, is a really powerful opiate, agreed by doctors to be around 3 times more powerful than OxyContin, and you will often take it for a long time as you recover. Yet, as we saw before, and has been proven beyond doubt, this almost never turns people into addicts. So how could a really powerful opiate cause virtually no addiction when given out by doctors, and an opiate that is 3 times weaker cause so much? This suggests we should look at the other possible explanation, a story taught to me by Bruce Alexander back on the streets of the downtown East Side. Bruce showed that at any given time, you and I and everyone around us has access to a huge array of chemicals that could drive away our pain for a while, from vodka to Valium. Almost all of the time, we leave them on the shelf, unused. So the question is, why are there sudden moments when large numbers of people scattered across different bathrooms and barrooms suddenly pick them up and swallow them compulsively, all at once? The answer doesn't lie in access. It lies in agony. Outbreaks of drug addiction have always taken place, he proved, when there was a sudden rise in isolation and distress, from the gin-soaked slums of London in the 18th century to the terrified troops in Vietnam. This raises the question, has anything happened in the United States in the past decade that could be the deep driver of the prescription drug crisis? It's not hard to find the answer. The American middle class has been painfully crumbling even before the Great Crash produced the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Ordinary Americans are finding themselves flooded with stress and fear. That, Bruce's theory suggests, is why we are leaning more and more heavily on OxyContin and Vicodin to numb their pain. This insight puts the prescription drug crisis in a different light. All those stressed-out moms hooked on Vicodin and all those truck drivers hooked on OxyContin have been seeing their incomes shrink and their abilities to look after their families wither for years, as their status and security in American society shrivel away. If Oxy had never been invented, Bruce's evidence suggests, at a moment like this, they would have found something else in their bathroom or liquor cabinet to give them some relief, because in every previous crisis like this, people have found something similar. It's not that the specific drug plays no effect. Clearly it does. Vicodin and Oxycontin do contain chemical hooks, and those do play some role in the addiction. Remember the evidence from earlier about how just 17% of tobacco addiction is caused by the chemical hooks in the drug? Given that tobacco is the most addictive drug, we would expect, at most, that the chemicals in Oxycontin play, at worst, a similar role in causing Oxycontin addiction. Now, 17% is a lot, and doctors should be conscious of it when they are prescribing these drugs to people who could be offered milder painkillers first, with fewer chemical hooks. But whichever way you cut it, 17% is still a small part of the effect. Focusing only on this smaller aspect and ignoring the much larger causes is one of the reasons why our responses to this crisis are failing so badly. Yet even after finding this out, I still had a nagging sense that there was something I was not understanding about the prescription drug crisis. So I researched more, and I kept bumping up against the third question thrown up by this crisis. Why are so many people starting with Oxycontin and Vicodin and ending up using heroin? This conveyor belt from prescription drugs to more potent stuff has been well documented. Nobody can deny it. And at first it seems to refute everything I learned in Switzerland. Indeed, this dynamic is so intense it has become the dominant issue in several states. The crisis is so severe in Vermont, for example, that the governor in 2014 dedicated his entire State of the State address to the surge in heroin use, and it was widely claimed that prescription opiates had been a major cause. Again, I discovered there are two stories about why this has happened. The first story is that this epidemic proves that the crisis is driven by chemicals. As your body becomes hooked, it clearly needs more and more powerful drugs to hit the same sweet spot. So your Oxy doesn't do it for you anymore, and you turn to heroin. This is what happens when you let the genie of access to drugs out of the bottle. It runs away with you. Again, it sounds reasonable. But there is another story about what has happened, one that requires you to understand a very different effect of our drug policy. This will sound weird at first, it did to me at least, but it is a well-proven effect. In fact, if you want to see it in action, you can go to any college football game in the United States, any weekend of the year, and watch it with your own eyes. The effect is called the Iron Law of Prohibition. To understand it, we have to first go back to the early 1920s and the reign of Arnold Rothstein, where our story began. The day before alcohol prohibition was introduced, the most popular drink in the United States was beer. But as soon as alcohol was banned, hard liquor soared from 40% of all drinks that were sold to 90%. People responded to a change in the law by shifting from a milder drink to a stronger drink. This seems puzzling. Why would a change in the law change people's tastes in alcohol? It turns out it didn't change their tastes. It changed something else. The range of drinks that were offered to them. The reason is surprisingly simple. One of the best analysts of the drug war, the writer Mike Gray, explains it in his book Drug Crazy. When you are smuggling a substance into a country and transporting it in secret, you have to put the maximum bang in the smallest possible package, he writes. Imagine secretly transporting a truckload of beer across the United States. You will be able to get, say, 100 people their drink for the night. But load the same truck with whiskey, and you will be able to get 1,000 people their drink for the night. So you're going to smuggle the whiskey. And when your drinkers come into your speakeasy, that's all that you will be able to offer them, along with even more toxic drinks like Billie Holiday's favorite, White Lightning, a booze so strong that even hardcore alcoholics would turn it down today. Most people want to get mildly intoxicated. Relatively few of us want to get totally shit-faced. But if no mild intoxicants are available, plenty of people will use a more extreme intoxicant, because it's better than nothing. Prohibition always narrows the market to the most potent possible substance. It's the iron law. Here's how you can see it for yourself, as I promised before, at a college football game in the United States. As Gray explains, students are normally beer drinkers, but since alcohol is prohibited at the stadium, they sneak in a flask and become whiskey drinkers. The stadium is a zone of alcohol prohibition, and the college kids end up drinking a much stronger kind of alcohol than they'd prefer because it's better than nothing. It works exactly the same way when you ban other drugs. Before drugs were criminalized, the most popular way to consume opiates was through very mild opiate teas, syrups, and wines. The best-selling Mrs. Winslow's Soothing Syrup, for example, contained 0.16 grain of morphine. One wine, laced with cocaine, Vin Mariani, was publicly recommended by Queen Victoria and Pope Leo XIII. The most popular way to consume coca was in teas and soft drinks, but within a few years of the introduction of prohibition, these milder forms of the drug had vanished. They were too bulky to smuggle, even though there was more demand for them. They weren't worth the risk for dealers like Arnold Rothstein. That's when coca tea was replaced by powder cocaine, and Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was replaced by injectable heroin. The harder you crack down, the stronger the drugs become. The crackdown on cannabis in the 1970s triggered the rise of skunk and super skunk. The crackdown on powder cocaine in the early 1980s led to the creation of crack, a more compact form of the drug. Many drug users want and prefer the milder forms of their drug, but they can't get them under prohibition, so they are pressed onto harder drugs. This is where the prescription drug crisis comes in, and we are forced to see it in a radically different light. Almost everyone who is addicted to OxyContin and gets cut off by their doctor wants to carry on using OxyContin. But under prohibition, it's really hard to get a mild opiate like Oxy, and pretty easy to get a hard opiate like heroin. That's how prohibited markets work. It's the iron law. Dr. Hal Vorse, who treats drug addicts in Oklahoma City, talked me through the economics of it bluntly, as his patients explain it to him day in, day out. Out on the streets, Oxy is 3 times more expensive than heroin, way beyond the price range of most addicts. So, he told me, they switched to heroin just because of the economics of it. Just as when all legal routes to alcohol were cut off, beer disappeared and whiskey won, when all legal routes to opiates are cut off, Oxy disappears and heroin prevails. This isn't a law of nature, and it isn't caused by the drug. It is caused by the drug policy we have chosen. After the end of alcohol prohibition, White Lightning vanished. Who's ever heard of it now? And beer went back to being America's favorite alcoholic drink. There are heroin addicts all across the United States today who would have stayed happily on Oxy if there had been a legal route to it. This is worth repeating, because it is so striking, and we hear it so rarely, despite all the evidence. The war on drugs makes it almost impossible for drug users to get milder forms of their drug, and it pushes them inexorably toward harder drugs. After absorbing all this, I realize we have been told a story about the prescription drug crisis that doesn't graft onto reality. The chemical is to blame, and if only we could eradicate the chemical, we could eradicate the problem. It's a tempting story because it's so simple, and allows us to avert our eyes from how much of this problem was created not by pills, but by people. The Swiss heroin experiment, combined with Rat Park, offers us the best answer not only to heroin, but to the prescription drug crisis too. One afternoon, in the heroin clinic in Geneva, I told one of the psychiatrists there, Dr. Mangui, about how this story had all happened before, long ago, in Los Angeles. Heroin was prescribed, people got better, then it was shut down. Then again, much later, in Liverpool, heroin was prescribed, people got better, then it was shut down. She stroked her wooden necklace, thinking. "It's like relapse in addiction," she said. "It might look discouraging, but at every relapse you learn something new." Chapter 16 The Spirit of 74. I had known for years that there was a country where all drugs, from cannabis to crack, were decriminalized in 2001. I wanted to understand what that meant, but I held off from visiting until nearly 2 years into this journey. I told myself it was because I wanted to end the story on an upbeat note. Here, dear reader, is the solution. But there was also another reason, one that I admitted to myself only in low moments. What if I go to see the alternative, and it doesn't work? What then? In 2013, I touched down in a sun-washed winter in Portugal to travel through this land of decriminalized drugs. I started by walking the streets of Lisbon for days, and I think I expected to see something different. Boys and girls sauntered hand in hand up and down the seven hills on which this capital city is built, through tiny, jagged, irrational medieval streets leading nowhere, and through vast, straight, rational avenidas that stretched to the sea. They sat out in the street drinking coffee and eating more cakes than seems possible for people with such slim waists and slimmer wallets. The people there live in small, brightly colored apartment blocks that stare across the avenidas and alleyways at each other, and from any window you can see into half a dozen homes. Underwear hangs from loosely strung wire to dry, where everyone can see it, unembarrassed, un-English. The people of Lisbon have a relaxed gaze, but it's always present, sipping its coffee, seeing you. In his anonymous little office in an official building, I met a man named João Goulao. He was wearing a brown suit and a brown tie, and he still spoke in the precise manner of the family doctor he was for so long. He was mild and rather conservative in demeanor, and yet he had led the biggest ever break in Harry Anslinger's global system. He was insistent on sharing credit and deflecting praise, but most people believe he pioneered the transformation here. Over a series of conversations, he, and many other participants in the Portuguese drug revolution, told me how they did it and why. A 19-year-old university student was flicking through a medical textbook in Portugal in 1973 when he found a secret message. It was written on tissue paper. Somebody had slipped it in there and then vanished. João Goulao read the message carefully. It was an underground newspaper demanding a revolution. João knew if he was found with these words, the secret police would come for him, and he would vanish. He had seen signs across the university campus demanding the return of students who had been disappeared. On the rare occasions when people organized a protest, the police unleashed their dogs and their batons, and more people vanished. A few days later, another student said to Joao, "Did you find something in your new book?" "Yes," he said. "What do you think about it?" "I think we must be very careful," Joao replied. But he added, "I enjoyed what I read." "I can give you more of those papers discreetly, if you want." And so Joao became a small part of the movement to free Portugal. This is not what his family expected of him. He grew up travelling in the 1950s and 1960s around the silenced interior of the country, moving from place to place through the dry rural heartland of the dictatorship. His father was an engineer whose job was to clear people off their land against their will, to make way for the dams that the government and the electric companies wanted to build. He was not popular. He carried a gun. Joao's family unquestioningly believed the regime propaganda that evil forces were trying to take over the country and destroy everything they knew. Where he grew up, nobody talked about politics beyond a smattering of vague clichés expressing this conviction, muttered to ward off more dangerous thoughts. He had just a vague sense that we had political police and that some people were missing. There was no discussion of it. It was a taboo. Now, after coming to the big city to study, he was learning the truth. At a bus stop, he asked one of his underground comrades about one of the articles he had read in the secret newspaper, and his friend responded by talking loudly about football. Joao was confused. Later, his friend told him, "Someone from the political police was getting close to us, to listen to our conversation." Joao knew something was being prepared. He heard whispers, but he didn't know when it would come. In the early hours of the morning of the 25th of April, 1974, Joao's brother-in-law, an officer in the Portuguese army, called his wife with a message that surprised her. "We have been plotting a revolution. It is here. We have begun." Tanks were already rolling through Lisbon, toward the treasury in the center of the city. The authorities ordered people to stay off the streets, and the radio played only marching music in a constant loop. But Joao, like tens of thousands of others, headed straight to the town center that morning. It was cold, and the city was holding its breath. Joao saw a boat on the river pointing its cannons at the governmental palace. He saw military columns on the street. In the narrow, cavernous roads of Lisbon, the tanks looked enormous and outsized, with machine guns pointing outward. Then there came the moment when Joao, and all the people standing on the streets alongside him, knew they were not going to be fired at by their country's military. Not ever again. The tanks rolling through the city paused when they met with an old lady who was setting up her flower stall. She smiled and gently tossed a single red carnation at the tank commander. By the afternoon, young girls had begun to approach the soldiers and place their own red carnations in the barrels of their guns. It was the moment when the Portuguese people lost their fear. People climbed onto the tanks and danced on them. The dictatorship was over. In the months that followed, there was an eruption of debates and demonstrations, and an unleashing of all the pent-up hopes of decades gone by, a festival of democracy. It was as though the dams his father built all those years had burst all at once. And so, Portugal was learning a lesson that would flood into this story. Nothing has to stay the same. If a dogma is not working, no matter how strong and immovable it seems, you can cast it aside and start anew. 2.5 decades later, At the start of the 21st century, João helped lead Portugal to do something remarkable and unprecedented. "It is," he tells me, when we meet in 2013,